Okay, I'm going to begin with the introductions. Good afternoon to you all. Hope you're enjoying the conference. We are now in what I'll call the championship rounds. Congratulations for making it this far. You're fighting like true champs. My name is Matthew Barton. I'm curator of recorded sound at the Library of Congress, and it is my pleasure to be chairing the television and technical topics panel, and I want to get right into that. We've changed the order just a little bit. Dan Blazek was listed as first, but we've had many requests that he be switched to last, so that people who are shuttling back and forth between the two rooms can be sure to hear him. And I think that's a tribute to both the enduring popularity of Groucho Marx and to Dan's enduring popularity as well. So instead of Dan leading off, we are going to start with Dave Walker's presentation. And Dave has served as audio digitization specialist in the Ralph Rinzler Folklife Archives and Collections at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage, Smithsonian Institution, since January 2014. He specializes in the preservation, conservation, and digital reformatting of analog audio media, especially open reel tapes and instantaneous discs. And his interest in recorded sound extends to best practices and standards in these areas and in special collections archival practice. And the title of his presentation is Preserving a Legacy, Conserving and Digitizing the Cook Labs Record Collection. Dave Walker.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks everyone for coming by and sticking around at the conference. Today, I'm going to be talking a little bit about a digitization project that we did at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife. This involved digitizing not only the audio, but the paper and photo records associated with Emery Cook, who is an engineer, and his record label. Just as a little bit of a background, Emery Cook is really, he was an engineer's engineer. In the 1930s, he went to MIT, and then from there, he started working with the U.S. Navy, developing radar systems for the USS North Carolina. From there, he went to Cornell and then started experimenting with radio technology and studied electrical engineering. After working in New York for a little bit, he decided that radio really wasn't his calling. Instead, it was the technology side of things that really interested him. In the 1950s, he presented at the AES conference, and he showed one of his new technologies, which was a binaural playback turntable, which was actually one of the earliest forms of commercial stereo. And it's really interesting because it involved using two needles that were playing back simultaneously. You can see him there showing it off. Now, at the time, he didn't realize that people were less interested in this new technology, and they actually liked the music that he was recording. Being an engineer, he was very focused on getting a very high signal-to-noise ratio. And so there was a significant improvement in reduction of noise and less pops and clicks. And that's really the driving force that carried him through his work all the way up into the 1980s. So these are some archival photographs that we came across, and I'm just presenting this to you guys as kind of context for the collection that we digitized. But you can see him there in the top left. He's cutting the lacquer discs in stereo. And to the right, you see a cone shape, the cone there, where he's trying to capture nature sounds, things like birds, thunderstorms, trains, jets, that sort of thing. Down on the bottom is some of his equipment. It is Stamford, Connecticut Laboratories. And he was just actively involved in the recording processes. Now, his label started in 1952, after people didn't really buy into the whole binaural, attachment that you had to purchase for your turntable. He wanted to release music that catered to a fairly wide audience, but not the type of stuff like Tin Pan Alley, like New York pop music. And so he featured a lot of recordings from all over the world, but primarily Trinidad and Tobago, where he had a vinyl record pressing plant that he had set up. And among Oh, for some reason it's a little too small. But in addition to featuring music, he was a wacky experimental engineer. I mean, he was out there just recording anything and everything, and he was willing to release it in small batches. One of his innovations was that he was able to produce small numbers of recordings thanks to a technology that he developed called microfusion. So instead of using a biscuit or a hockey puck shape piece of vinyl, as most stampers do, he developed a system of pressing using a very fine vinyl powder, which improved the signal in that. So less pops, less clicks, and it could be done in very small quantities. And for this reason, this is why it really made sense for, in the 1990s, the Smithsonian Folkways Records would acquire this collection. Some of y'all might know the senior archivist at Folklife, Jeff Place. He was the one who got in contact with Emery Cook when Cook decided that he wanted to pass his legacy along, with the stipulation that the material would be available for purchase indefinitely. In addition to the commercial albums, we received a substantial amount of his personal and business papers. This included over 600 original master tapes, which had never been released. These are things like outtakes, field recordings, back and forths with friends, in addition to photographs of his operations, his family, handwritten letters, artist contracts, that sort of thing. And so in 2013 and 2014, the archive decided to digitize this entire collection to make it available for researchers. In addition, we also got a handful of objects, which included his dual tone arm, some of that vinyl powder, and a number of his stampers that were used down in Trinidad. So just as kind of like a general overview, we wanted to prioritize the collection and digitize it from top to bottom. Nothing left behind, no cherry picking. Of sorts. Processing was done primarily through the generous time of graduate library science students at UMD, along with interns and our processing archivist, Greg Adams. Digitization of the photos took place during this time as well, and we adhere to what's called the FAGI standard, which is the Federal Agency's Digitization Guideline Initiative. It's a mouthful, but it basically just sets the bar for high-resolution reformatting. And that's what we follow in our day-to-day operations. And so we photograph documents, tape boxes, film negatives, audio recordings. After digitization, we embedded with crucial metadata. And really at the core of this project is it was a collaborative digitization. This wasn't just people sitting in a room digitizing audio all day. It was a constant back and forth, a positive back and forth with our film and photo scanning technicians, because so much content is provided in these paper documents that provide context to the audio recordings. In some cases, the audio tapes are minimally labeled. You might have a single number that was ascribed, which means nothing by our records. But by consulting the paper documents, you can understand a little bit more about those tapes. And then finally, all the digital objects are ingested into the Smithsonian Digital Asset Management System. And I'll just kind of give you a brief overview. So as I said before, we're digitizing at 600 PPI, 16-bit color, and a lot of the material was done through intern assistance. As for the audio, a lot of these tapes were from the 1950s, so they're acetate-backed. And in some cases, they were stored in less than ideal conditions. Some of the worst of those were those stored in Trinidad, where it was not climate-controlled. It was very humid, a lot of exposure to mold, mildew, that sort of thing. And then it ended up in a basement for a while. So fast forward 60 years later, we're digitizing these tapes with every intention of trying to capture what's on that tape authentically. So they're very fragile. And for our purposes, we chose between two tape decks, One is the Tascam BR20, and the other is the Otari MX5050. And we found that the Otari was very helpful for those acetate tapes suffering from vinegar syndrome, things that experience cupping, wrinkling, and just general deformation from having very loosely packed tapes. So as I mentioned before, mold was a huge issue. In terms of treatment, we used a solution of isopropyl alcohol diluted in distilled water, and we made a couple passes with that, and that seemed to get the job done. And it really cut down on regeneration of spores. There were so many splices in these tapes. Being an engineer, this guy, he was making upwards of 50 in some cases, and every single one of those had to be replaced before digitization could take place. We used naphtha-based lighter fluid with a Q-tip. It got the job done. We clean our tapes. So one thing that we do is we do a low-contact pass using medical-grade Kimtech wipes, which is similar to Pellon fabric, which is often used to clean video. And we found that reduced the amount of oxide transfer onto the tape. Now, what we found is that there was no additional oxide taken off other than what otherwise would end up on the heads and the tape path. As mentioned before, we had a lot of cupping and warping and things like that. And making these tapes intellectually accessible was really key. So rehousing the tapes was crucial. The tape boxes were old, deteriorating, sometimes had mold, dust. So they needed to be put in into polypropylene stable tape boxes. Now, you'll see on the right, that's a list of our collection as it's broken down in our digital asset management system. It's a little hard to read, but basically, we arrange our digital objects in our digital asset management system the same way that you would have an archival finding aid. So it's arranged according to series. So series one, in this case, is business papers. You have contracts, correspondence. At the very end is audio recordings. We found that by having this analog between our digital objects reflecting our archival finding aid, researchers can find this stuff like that. It's very quick. In terms of the digital objects, we embedded metadata according to the FADGI standards. So BWF chunk had things like keywords, artist names, bulk dates, and photos had the same sort of thing. And we were able to develop a list of keywords and genre terms with the other archivists so that we were all on the same page. And so if you wanted to find Trinidadian drum percussion, you could find not only photos, but references to it in documents, as well as audio recordings. And we're using Archivist Toolkit at the moment to have all of our information, to store all of our information about the archival collections. So this right here is a screenshot of the SI dams. And you'll see there's the audio recordings there, but they're also linked with the scans of the tape boxes. So if you type in the tape number, you can zoom very high resolution and look at all the handwriting. This is peripheral information that tells you a lot about the tape, even in some cases when it's crossed out. It provides context that you can't get otherwise. So we argued that it was very important to retain this information in some form, even though we're not hanging on to the tapes themselves. So now that everything's been digitized, we want to make this stuff accessible. So our plan is to determine the rights and restrictions and make it available for online distribution. The nature of contracts is such that you don't want to always let that stuff leak out online. So we have to be very prudent with what we publish. We have plans of putting together an online reading room to make this stuff available remotely. At the moment, we get a lot of researchers who come in on site to look at the material. In fact, one gentleman from Texas is working using the technical diagrams that Cook had to recreate this microfusion vinyl pressing process. So as an alternative to the traditional process. So We also had a number of researchers interested in the history of steel drums and Calypso. And eventually, our finding aids are going to be published on an upcoming Smithsonian finding aid platform, where once you're within the finding aid, you can click and the material, the digital objects are delivered from the SI dams. So it's right there as like a gallery. And this is just little fun stuff. I'll go through a couple pictures for you guys. This is one of his pressings machines. And in the top, you can see some folks hard at work. And that's the clamshell right there. It's about just a little bit bigger than the size of a 12-inch disc. But it just opens up, hinges, and you paste this vinyl powder in, close it, put it in the pressing machine, and boom, you're done. And that's kind of some stuff for the techies out there. These are some audio tape machines that he had in his studios. And yeah, so if there's any questions, feel free to ask.
Okay, Dave should get some kind of award for finishing so far before his allotted time. So since we do have a lot of people, do we have any questions right now? We can do some more at the end, but are there any immediate questions for Dave? Sorry? Right. You know, you're making it very hard on the rest of us.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we hold questions until the end? Okay, very good.
All right. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, didn't even get to give him the high sign. It's really throwing my rhythm off. What can I tell you?